Today on Central Standard, poet William Trowbridge.
On Fool's Birthday, April 1st, people play jokes on him all day long. April Fool, his wife and kids hoot as the pancakes explode. Gotcha again, quips the gang at work when he sits down in the Limburger cheese. His mom and dad, though dead, always call to ask if he has Prince Albert in a can. We'll let him out, they shriek, not waiting for an answer. By 5 o'clock, Fool feels like a spacewalker cut loose from the mothership. The radio in his head chatters nonsense as he floats end over end. You are my sunshine, he sings, sotto voce. My only sunshine.
That's on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. The term Ship of Fools is one of the most enduring allegories in Western literature and art. A vessel populated by mankind, oblivious of direction or destination, floating, all in the same boat, each one a fool by himself. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Joining us now is poet, author, and English professor William Trowbridge, whose latest work is called Ship of Fools. Just One Fool, a wily collection of poems depicting a man wandering aimlessly through everyday situations like only a fool can. Bill Trowbridge, which you prefer to be called, tell us how the project Ship of Fool came about.
Well, it goes way back for me. I used to be a big fan when they used to run silent movies on TV. I guess they've started doing it again now, but I became a big fan of Buster Keaton, who is one of the classic fool figures, and then I began to notice fools in in literature, in stand-up comedy, in film, in just about anywhere you look in the culture, there's a fool figure, and I began to identify with the fool quite a bit, too. So he was in the back of my mind for a long time. This is my fifth poetry collection. I finally decided to focus on that figure, who is an archetype who goes back to probably, you know, the first story that was told somewhere back in the cave, probably had a fool in it, and the fool is a recurring figure in literature and culture from in not only our culture but probably any culture. And so there was a lot to draw on there, and I decided to just write one poem about him. Called Fool's Paradise. It's the lead poem in my book, it prompted me to write another poem about Fool, and then another poem and another poem, and finally I decided maybe there's enough for a whole book, and lo and behold, there was.
What you argue or what you put forth in that poem that you just mentioned, Fool's Paradise, is an idea from John Milton.
Right.
Going all the way back to Paradise Lost.
Right.
That fools are here from the beginning of creation.
From the very beginning, yes. Yeah. They're Adam and Eve. Well, Adam was probably a good fool figure, too.
Certainly. So when you say God makes his fool a Stratocaster, what do you mean?
I was playing off the old romantic poetry notion that the romantic poets, some of them, said that they're actually not writing the poem, that they're simply opening themselves up and the divine spirit moves through them and plays them like an instrument, like their favorite image. There's even a poem, I think Coleridge has a poem called The Aeolian Harp. The Aeolian Harp is a harp that you put in the window. And you open the window, if it's cold outside and warm inside, there'll be a wind current, and it'll play the strings. And that was their image. So I kind of thought, well, what if we put Fool in there? And so he becomes a Stratocaster, and then Orlitz or Argon, and then finally, what does he become finally? Just
a fool.
A fool, yes.
Does making the fool an individual give more weight to a society of fools, or is this simply one fool?
Oh, I think he's representative of all of society. We were talking before the program. I think any person, any human being who cannot see at least a little fool in him or herself is not seeing very clearly. So, yeah, my fool is a representative of a certain element in the human condition. And so, again, that makes him a pretty rich figure to write about.
So it's fair to say that perhaps if you don't see the fool in yourself, you're fooling yourself.
Yeah, you're a fool nevertheless.
Let's hear your first selection titled Roll Out the Fool. What's happening to and with your fool archetype in this poem?
Okay, there's an epigraph to this poem that makes a very important point about fools. It's from a book called The Fool, His Social and Literary History by Enid Welsford. And the quote is, St. Chrysostom formulated the most comprehensive and fundamental definition when he described the fool as he who gets slapped. He who gets slapped.
And, right. And that's a pretty strict definition.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty straightforward.
And it's a significant element in the fool figure. He gets slapped a lot. He gets his butt kicked frequently.
This fool does.
And it goes back to an element of comedy that involves pain. The old vaudeville slapstick. You know, you hit somebody with a slapstick, and it makes it sound like you really hit them hard, and everybody laughs.
And it is an enduring theme in comedy
to this
day.
The pratfall. There's a lot of violence visited upon fools and clowns, and they seem to attract it in some way. So I sort of went with that. He who gets slapped is also there's a Lon Chaney movie called He Who Gets Slapped, which is based on a Russian play called He Who Gets Slapped, which also was made into a movie. So that phrase tends to get bounced around quite a bit. So anyway, this is Roll Out the Fool. In cave days, fool mated with the pratfall, the hotfoot, the bully's brunt. His deadpan so endearing when his head met stone, he was voted best victim. The teens loved it, grown-ups too. He tamed their blood pressure and kept their worldview cheerful as a cannibal hoedown. But they wanted more, something real good. No more chipped by cuspids or routine flesh wounds. So they'd making up clubbing dummy, spear catcher, all-day torch, saber-tooth lure. Forest gatherings lacked the proper tang without a flaming fool, exploding fool, or, big mistake, a fool frappé, which, one snowy night, everybody ate, like it was brain food or something. So now we've got fool in our marrow, which explains history for one thing.
That's from the poem Roll Out the Fool from the collection Ship of Fool, written by our guest William Bill Trowbridge, I might add. There's fool in our marrow, which explains history. That's pretty much the theme of this.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
He who gets slapped.
He who gets slapped.
Why is that so funny? Why did that evoke a involuntary, knee-jerk reaction in me, for instance?
It's a puzzle. I don't think anybody's solved quite yet why people. I mean, I suppose one notion would be, well, it happened to him and not me, so I can laugh.
Right.
Or he kind of asked for it by being dumb. But I'm not sure there's one answer that you can give for that. But again, it's interesting that this figure associated with fun and joy and laughing is also attracts violence.
He gets into some pretty whimsical situations, as you mentioned, and as we're seeing. Sometimes you get the feeling that maybe he's even in on the joke. Is that true in certain instances?
I'm not sure if fool's ever really in on the joke. He has trouble getting jokes, and that's one of the things that kind of gets him in trouble. He doesn't quite understand how to put himself into the world, and quite often as a result of that, the world is fairly hard on him.
But he thinks he's funny in a lot of instances.
But in a lot of incidents, he's not quite sure why people are laughing.
speaking of which, let's hear another one of your passages from Ship of Fools, Seismic.
Okay.
What is this about? Seismic.
Seismic is it just came to me one day. I was thinking of Fool's sort of extra sensibility he sometimes has, and this one he is able to pick up signals from people who are dead, and in his own weird way. There's a reference to something called the Bronx Cheer. I hope everybody remembers what the Bronx Cheer is. It's not a regular cheer. The Bronx Cheer is basically
right.
So, yeah, and
my father being from the Bronx, I'm
right, okay,
familiar
yeah,
with that.
Yeah. And then there's also a reference at the end to a Rolling Stones song called Jumpin' Jack Flash. Seismic. On damp days, fools' feet pick up vibrations from the dead, who still want answers, who've been on hold too long. They're not that dead, they insist. Voices crowding up like bubbles in a boiling pot. Fool steps gingerly as they carry on about loaded dice and thumbs on the scales, bum wiring and worse plumbing, cracks and leaks, fizzles and ruptures. But it's not all grief down there. Sometimes they sing, "Roll Me Over," for example, or in stormy weather, "Stormy Weather." Today, they aim a Bronx cheer at what makes the flesh so fickle. But too many tongues fall out, or are already gone, which leads to a brief dirge of bone clatter that they flip into a marimba band take on Jumpin' Jack Flash. But it's all right now, they sass. In fact, it's a gas, which makes fool look both ways and try a little strut.
The poem was titled Seismic and was from the latest poetry collection titled Ship of Fool, written by William Trowbridge. You're listening to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We're live on 89.3 FM KCUR with a live stream at kcur.org. Our guest today, as I mentioned, is Bill William Trowbridge, poet, author, and English professor, whose latest work is called Ship of Fool. This collection, Bill, reads almost like a story out of sequence, vignettes of almost sitcom-like proportions. Was that intentional?
Yes, it was intentional. I did not want to have this read like a narrative with a beginning, middle, end, and in chronological order. Because Fool is an archetype, he exists basically in all times and all places. So to sort of go with that, I deliberately jumbled things so that Fool will be in the Middle Ages in one poem, and the next poem he will be watching the Super Bowl, and then he'll go back to Shakespearean times. He is unstuck in time. That's a line from Kurt Vonnegut's description of Billy Pilgrim from Slaughterhouse-Five, but Fool is like Billy Pilgrim. He's unstuck in time. He pops up at one time. He pops up at another time. He's also unstuck in space, in the sense that he is sometimes moving along in the earthly realm, and sometimes he winds up in the heavenly realm. Starts out there in Fool's Paradise, where he gets kicked out of heaven with the bad angels. Sorry, he gets kicked out by accident, but it's, you know, he's always having bad luck like that. And he pops back up in heaven every once in a while, and because he dies, so he goes back up to heaven and gets his batteries charged, and then goes back and gets usually gets killed again, and he's sort of bouncing back and forth from between the earthly and heavenly life throughout the book.
And so it goes.
Yeah, so it goes.
The transcendental
yeah.
fool.
Yeah,
he's a very adventuresome as well, trying a bit of everything.
Yes,
he's the type of guy that actually answers those spam ads in an email for mail enhancement products.
Definitely answer that.
Is this a nod to consumerism? Is this a nod a little bit to the fool as a consumer?
He's the quintessential sucker, and so I think, you know, consumerism has that element in it, and in that sense, yeah, there's a little bit of consumer in him.
In a lot of instances, speaking of happiness being bliss, ignorance being bliss, you have Fool walking proudly, almost prideful strides in his adventures. What are you trying to illustrate with this sort of foolish, oblivious bliss?
Just that, I guess. The only way he can really be very blissful is to be oblivious of what's happening to him and what's going on around him. When he gets to be blissful, it usually doesn't last very long.
Let's hear another selection, Basic Fool.
Okay.
What is this about? What makes this fool basic in this particular piece?
Well, I was playing off the term basic training or boot camp, and it's a kind of love poem, but in Fool's case, love is mostly like a boot camp rather than a pleasant experience. So that's where Basic Fool comes from. Basic Fool. Get down and give me 20, snaps Cupid. Fool pumps away, boots burnished, seams crisp, making choo-choo sounds. Show me your love face, snarls the cherub, after Fool wobbles to attention. Love face, maggot, Cupid shrieks, as Fool mugs like a chimpanzee having a stroke. Fool starts to think he should have tried something easier, like fire eating or celibacy. After a night of introspection, he hijacks a tank and drives over Cupid, leaving a trail of feathers and baby fat. Later, he takes a high-speed joyride in somebody's Porsche with a waitress he's picked up. You may not believe this, Fool tells her right before the blowout, but I'm a flyboy from the infantry of love.
Wow. A flyboy from the infantry of love. You can find witty turns of phrase like that in the poem Basic Fool from the collection Ship of Fool, written by our guest Bill Trowbridge, poet, author, and English professor. Some of this stuff sounds fun. Is the fool having fun?
He is sometimes, yes. He's having fun, but he should always be looking over his shoulder for something that's going to whack him pretty soon when he's having fun.
This collection of fool poems definitely reads like skits and funny vignettes, but there's an interesting thing that happens in the collection. The fool saga, as it were, seems to sandwich poems about childhood education, standards, and nostalgia. What was the purpose in grouping the fool poems with pieces such as My Father's Laugh and Pantsing Bobby Freeman in Fifth Grade and School Lesson and pieces that with names such as that?
Well, I wanted to have a middle section in the book where I got away from the fool character and included poems about foolishness in its various forms. And so the middle section of the book is tends to be slightly autobiographical because I feel like I'm a very close relative to Fool. And they don't involve the character Fool. So there's a little intermission, if you will, and then we go back to Fool in the third. The book has three sections, and then we go back to Fool in the third section.
Now back to Fool, basically.
Yeah.
Back to your regularly scheduled programming.
That's right.
Why do you feel like a distant relative to Fool, and how do you infuse that into these childhood foolishness poems?
I think everyone ought to feel like a distant relative to Fool, and I sort of recognized that fairly early in my life that one of my reasons for being fascinated with these Fool figures in film and literature and stand-up was that I identified with them. When Rodney Dangerfield says, "I get no respect," you know, we can all kind of plug into that, can't we, at one time or another? And when Buster Keaton does a pratfall, you can think, well, you know, I can identify with that. You know, I've had days like that. So, I've felt that kinship early on. And as I said before, I think everybody should.
I've gone AWOL from the infantry of love
a
couple of times, as it were. Sort of a first cousin removed from Fool myself. Let's hear another one of your Fool poems. Tell us the basis for what you're about to read, a poem titled Playing the Fool.
Okay, Playing the Fool is it started with my thinking. I have a PhD in English and American literature, so a lot of literature bounces around in my head. And I was for some reason thinking about the Romantic poets' notion of the artist or the poet who they say is not really writing the poem himself, but simply or herself is simply opening up to the divine spirit that flows through them, and they're being played like an instrument by this divine spirit, and that's what that then the poem comes out like that. So I thought, what if I plunked Fool in that sort of situation? What sort of instrument would he be? And so playing the Fool came out. Playing the Fool. God makes Fool his Stratocaster. Purple haze he commands, and blue Hawaii twangs down to earth, creating Muzak, hemorrhoids, and the Super Bowl halftime show. Toccata and fugue, he says to Fool, his Wurlitzer, and something akin to a 45 of Tutti Frutti played off center descends, and with it, 40 wars, smallpox, and the birth of Richard Nixon. Okay, says God to Fool, his kazoo, turkey in the straw, anything, at which heavens crack apart from a high note worthy of the cast from Revelation, unleashing chaos and, with a blinding electrical pop, old night. Fine, says God. Thanks for nothingness.
That poem was titled Playing the Fool and was from the latest poetry collection, Ship of Fool, written by Bill Trowbridge, poet, author, and English professor who goes by the name of William Trowbridge in his writings. He's our guest today. Now, you had a bit of a fool experience with the first poem you ever wrote. Tell us what happened.
I think probably a number of people can remember doing this, but my first poem was probably in college. I came home very drunk one night and for some reason took pen and paper and felt that I was ready to write the great poem and wrote it, and it seemed incredibly great to me, and then I went to sleep very rapidly, and when I woke up, after my head stopped throbbing, I rushed over to see how my poem was doing, and it didn't do well for some reason. It was awful. It was embarrassing, and I tore it up and threw it away and didn't write poems for a long time after that. But
is that something – would Fool do the same thing?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there's a piece of evidence of my identifying with Fool. That would be Fool's method of composition probably.
And what made you get back on the horse, so to speak?
Well, I started out as a philosophy major in college, and in fact, I got my bachelor's degree in philosophy at University of Missouri, Columbia. But I'd always been interested in literature. My thesis was going to be about philosophical ideas in literature, and I finally decided when I was working my master's degree that I was more interested in literature than philosophy. So I switched majors and went on and got a PhD at Vanderbilt. And while I was studying for my PhD comprehensive exam, we had to know a lot of stuff for that, and I was boning up on modern poetry, and suddenly something bit me one day when I was working, and I thought, well, maybe I'll try one of these, and I had so much fun with it, I tried another one and another one, and finally I wound up with, I think, 10 or 12 poems, which a month or so later, I shyly took to one of my professors to show him to see if he thought they were worth anything. And he liked them enough to recommend that I enter them in the Academy of American Poets contest on the Vanderbilt campus. And to my surprise, I won that. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll keep doing this. But I, at the same time, I was being trained as a scholar, not as a poet. So when I graduated, my first teaching job was as an American Lit scholar, not as a poet, and I basically had to sort of retool myself while I was teaching full time into writing more and more poetry and doing less and less scholarship till I turned myself into a poet.
William Trowbridge, better known as Bill Trowbridge, poet, author, scholar, English professor. He's our guest today. When we return, we discuss more about his latest poetry collection, Ship of Fools, and a discussion about poetry meeting music as we delve into Ship of Fools, the musical.
The musical.
The musical.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. There have been no less than half a dozen novels with the title Ship of Fools and about 20 songs with that title as well, along with several paintings and tapestries throughout history, one of the most enduring phrases and concepts in Western literature and art. But a local poet has taken a slightly different approach to making a group of fools into an individual who gets beat up on Caribbean vacations, answers ads for any and everything, and loves being a fool, unbeknownst to himself. Joining us once again in this half hour is Bill Trowbridge, whose pen name is William Trowbridge, poet, author, English professor, and his latest work is Ship of Fool, singular. He's taken his poetry epic of Fool's Errands even further with his poetry accompanied by music, as we'll hear in this half hour. Tell us about Fool the Musical.
Well, it was something I wasn't thinking about at all when I, even when I'd finished this book. But long time ago, when I was teaching freshman English at Northwest Missouri State, this must be 25, 30 years ago, a freshman appeared in my class named Bob Walkenhorst, who I, having taught him for a semester, I felt he was a tremendously bright guy and a very good student. He was an art major at the time, and then he, the class was over, and I didn't see him again, although I began to hear about him because he started a band called the Rainmakers, which became very successful regionally, and in fact were beginning to do European tours before Bob decided that he had had enough of the rock and roll life and wanted to sort of settle down, and went back to Kansas City and raised a family and got a day job. And I moved to Kansas City in 2010, and my wife and I started going to All Souls Unitarian Church, and lo and behold, there was Bob Walkenhorst playing a musical number at the church. So I went up and introduced myself after the service. We got to talking, and he looked my book over and noticed there were a lot of song references in it, and suggested, you know, it might be fun to see what happened if he sort of accompanied me. And I wasn't sure how, well, neither one of us were sure how that was going to come out, but we were invited by the minister to be the sermon one Sunday. So we did about a 20-minute bit with me reading fool poems and Bob accompanying with acoustic guitar and singing, and it was a smash hit. So we decided, seeing Bob's got a lot of skill making CDs, why don't we try doing a CD? And lo and behold, Ship of Fool, the musical, evolved.
So what did you know about Bob back when he was a student that sort of stuck out? And what sticks out in working with him decades later?
His incredible talent sticks out. He was really smart and wrote really, really terrific stuff without much help of much instruction, I think. He's just basically a brilliant guy. And his ability to put this together, I mean, I read the poems. Bob came over and we recorded me reading all the poems that were going to be in the book, and then he did all the rest. He did all the editing. He did all the flexing around. He did, we talked about what songs would go with what poems, but basically Bob designed the, he also has a degree in design, and he designed the album cover and the design of that's on the actual CD. He did about 3/4 of the work on the CD.
But this is not necessarily a musical.
No, it's not like a Broadway play or something. It was, we thought it was very important for The music not to overwhelm the poems. So the music is basically there as to provide sort of codas in between the poems and for a little accompaniment every once in a while during the poem. And Bob even put in some sound effects, which I thought were very, very effective.
How does music add to the effect of your reading and give us a feeling of the fool's journey?
It enriches it, I think. You've got two things going on here. Once you've got the poems and you've got the music going, and they complement each other, and there's a whole sort of new dimension, for me anyway, that opens up when I hear these things.
And what opens up for you?
Well, this experience, if you will, of musical poetry.
Does it subdue your fool, or does it make your fool even more foolish?
It doesn't subdue him at all, I think. It makes him shine.
Your poems on this album, interestingly enough, are paired with riffs from popular songs, such
right.
as Daylight Come and Right Said Fred's I'm Too Sexy. Why did you guys decide to go that route versus having original complimentary lyrics from Bob Walking Horse?
Well, there are original complimentary lyrics from him, too. In fact, there's a whole song in the next to the last poem is a song that Bob wrote and the Rainmakers recorded. And there are a couple of other times there, too. And the last one, which I think you're going to play, is the music there is basically the finale that they did for one of their rock and roll concerts here in Kansas City, edited into it in pieces.
Still, interestingly enough, by pairing some of these fool tales with musical moments in pop culture and also mentioning musical moments in pop culture in some of the poems in the book, is the intention to remind us that fool created pop culture or that pop culture created fool?
Well, I think there's a reciprocal sort of relationship there that they both sort of feed on each other.
Well, let's hear a selection from the spoken word album Ship of Fool, the musical, based on the book Ship of Fool. Let's go to that now.
Flight of the Fool, 1902. There was the wood and canvas number with 16 wings that folded up on takeoff like a book slamming shut. And the one topped with reciprocating umbrella, which pumped itself to scrap heap. And the rocket packet on the back of ice skating fool, which danced him into a crashing double axle. One by one, his inspirations mayday'd down to sad kersplats. Until today, when an oily pitchman from Daedalus Hides and Elixirs tells him their motorized pigskin wings kit for $3 a month, plus shipping and handling. Using the easy-to-apply assembly wax, Fool's ready for the wild blue yonder in less than a week. As he taxis down a hill, he feels the lift, slight at first, then more, though he's headed toward some telegraph wires. One giant step for mankind, and one dead pigeon, thinks Fool, who revs for dear life as the wind thrusts him toward a high-speed garroting. But then, look, up in the sky, it's Fool banking unsteadily over the south end of town, bringing good news to the Smiths and Joneses, to the Third National Bank and First Baptist Church, to Grimm's Dry Goods and Payne's Dentistry. Deliverance, every earthling free as the bat-like apparition now attempting rolls and figure eights above the water tower. Heaven's nearer, Fool plans to show the meager crowd, who shade their eyes and squint as he climbs toward the sun, sputtering higher and higher till he's a small black dot, then nothing. And they, bemused for a moment, turn back to their familiar avenues. Well, we went around and up and down and inside and back again.
clouds go by. Light up in the sun above the rain. You can buy me sitting in a deck chair high up over Kansas City. In a genuine, authentic, old-fashioned steam power down your brain.
That was Flight of Fool. Flight of the Fool, a selection from the spoken word album Ship of Fool, the musical, based on the latest poetry collection book, Ship of Fool, written by our guest, William Trowbridge, a.k.a. Bill Trowbridge. You're listening to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We're live on 89.3 FM KCUR with a live stream at kcur.org. The poem you just heard, as I mentioned, was Flight of the Fool set to music. What's that about? Flight of the Fool.
It's a
other than him getting up in an airplane.
It's a redoing of the Icarus and Daedalus story. You may recall that the myth was they were escaping from a labyrinth, and they created a plane. Icarus, the father, was the craftsman, created some wings that they could fly out of the labyrinth, and he told Daedalus, you know, whatever you do, don't fly too close to the sun, because the wood is stuck together with wax. And so he did, of course, being the usual obedient son, he flew right towards the sun, and it melted the wax, and down he went. So fool buys the kit from Daedalus.
Shipping and handling, $3.95.
Yeah, pays shipping and handling, and has the wax stuff there, and goes up and disappears like Daedalus did.
Are we to assume that he went too close
to
the sun
and
disappeared?
Fall of Icarus, I guess. Icarus is the one that fell down, yeah.
What about Fool? Does he go up too far?
Yeah, he goes too far, as Fool often does, and the wax melts, and down he goes. But you don't get to see that because he's just a little dot. He's gone so high there.
But you get the sense throughout the piece that this fool is going to crash.
It's going to crash, yeah. Well, anything fool touches, I think, tends to break or crash.
How did you frame your reading in this process? Did you think of a cadence when you wrote it, or did it come together with the music, or did it come together when you started to read it back to yourself?
I guess I think a lot about cadence, about stresses in lines, and I'm thinking about it from the minute I write the poem. Usually, I'm going over them in my head, and when I'm revising, I'm looking for passages that where the cadence gets lost a little bit, and need tinkering or revising. So, I think most poets have a strong sense of rhythm and cadence, even if they're not writing iambic pentameter. When I'm talking to my classes about so-called free verse, I emphasize that, you know, it may be free in one sense, but words still have accents. You know, some syllables are pronounced stronger than other syllables, and so the stressors are going to be there if you don't pay any attention to them. And then that's going to be something in the poem that may be working for the poem, or may be working against the poem. You won't even know it. So, yeah, I think a lot about stresses and rhythms and cadences.
And how do you make that choice when it comes down to the choice on stresses and rhythms and cadences? What words will have emphasis? What words will have life? What words will be subdued?
It depends on what's being said in the line a lot of times. If I have a line where I'm talking about rapid movement, I will try to make the stresses very smooth so the line can read fast. If I'm talking about something that's clumsy and clunky, I'll put words that have strong stresses right together, so the line will imitate, if you will. There's a relationship. Lawrence Perrine, the scholar, once put together a book called Sound and Sense, and he was basically taking Alexander Pope's edict from Essay on Criticism that he wrote, that the sound should be an echo to the sense. And so you should think of what the line is saying when you're thinking about what cadences are going to go in that line, and they'll be different for different lines sometimes.
We're about to get into, in a few moments, a selection called World's Biggest Fool. What's the basis for both the poem and the inspiration behind its musical pairing?
I guess The Tall Tale was one of my inspirations for it. Goes back to 19th century American folk humor. I decided to see how big was Fool going to get, and he comes out very, very big in this case. And the accompaniment This is kind of the finale of the album, and so there's a kind of big rock and roll finale sort of that goes into the behind this poem.
What does World's Biggest Fool do, and what does World's Biggest Fool say to the world?
What does he do? He doesn't really do anything. It gets done to him again. He suddenly finds himself getting big, and he didn't really ask to be that way. But when he gets so big, and his mind begins to get much smarter, also even though he didn't volunteer to have that happen, he begins to sort of reorder the world and make the half-hour work week and the truly bottomless margarita until God steps in, who feels like he's, you know, taken over his job and kicks Fool out of that. But that's what Fool does once he gets these amazing powers temporarily.
So Fool is so foolish that he becomes inadvertently self-aware and omnipotent,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
Let's hear these exploits in World's Biggest Fool.
World's Biggest Fool. At the doctor's, Fool notices his weight's up, almost half a ton. No wonder his jeans cut and his old shoes pinch so. He gets a new outfit at a big men's store, which helps till he puts on another 2 tons. The tabloids show an interest, but Fool finds himself thinking big, hatching ideas that wouldn't have squeezed into his normal-sized head, now larger than a big boy statue's. Is the pleasure of the pig as great as the pleasure of the philosopher? He asks the mailman, feeling concepts roll through his mind like happy sea otters. He begins to see through the pea soup of everydayness, then through corduroy, then oak tables. His doctor says it must be a nervous affliction, brought on by chronic ineptitude and water retention. He prescribes strong diuretics and 2 weeks in the Caymans. But Fool's grown too big to fit inside a plane or atop a cruise ship. He acquires his own field of gravity, then bounds through the ionosphere and into space, where he takes his place as the 9th planet in our solar system. China draws up plans to colonize him, the CIA to terminate him with extreme prejudice. Now, God has to admit Fool's jammed the gears again, making life difficult for everybody. Another word he uses to mean himself. Meanwhile, Fool's discovered the missing link, the lost cord, the cure for cancer and old age, and devised the half-hour work week. He's really, really big now. Too big to kill with a bolt of lightning or the old pillar of salt stunt. Fool's heart takes up a galaxy. There's room in it for all humankind, even burdens on society and threats to public decency. Everybody, which of course includes God, now adrift inside that humongous ticker, flushed from auricle to ventricle, awash in the blood of a fool. Out goes sin, out goes death, in comes the free pass and the truly bottomless margarita, which set off God's doomsday device for when life gets too good for our own good. Bang goes the whole shebang, leaving God back at square one. Okay, goddammit, he sighs. From the top, let there be light, blah, blah, blah. Back on Earth, Fool, reincarnated to his old size and kick-me grin, grabs a fig leaf and tries to look busy.
That was World's Biggest Fool, the grand finale of Fools, a selection from the spoken word album Ship of Fool, the musical, based on the latest poetry collection, Ship of Fool, the poetry, the book, written by William the Bill Trowbridge, author, poet, and professor of English. Speaking of professorship, you have an interesting commute as a professor. You're a professor emeritus at Northwest Missouri State, but you also teach at the University of Nebraska's MFA writing program, low residency program. What is meant by low residency?
Well, I'm retired from Northwest Missouri State. I still have the rank of distinguished professor emeritus, but that's sort of a retirement title. So my actual teaching is now part time because I'm spending more time on my writing and having fun. I teach at this University of Nebraska program, which, as you say, is a low residency, which means that they only meet on campus 10 days out of the semester. The rest of the time, they meet 10 days at the beginning of the semester, then everybody goes home. So I go to Nebraska City, where their residency is held. It's not held at the Lincoln campus. It's held in a resort hotel in Nebraska City, which is kind of nice, too.
And I was going to say that actually sounds terrible.
Yeah, it's really tough living.
Right.
So it's very intense 10 days there. It runs from about 8 in the morning till 9 at night with time off for meals and things. And so we get everybody oriented, have workshops, lectures, readings there. And then the students select who they want to be their teacher.
Which means you have a whole bunch of students, an astronomical number, two.
Two, that's right, yeah. There, you're allowed a maximum of five because this is a program that very much concentrates on a sort of one-on-one teacher-student relationship rather than dealing with a big class.
So how do the students come to pick you? And when they do pick you, why do they say they pick you? How do you find out that they pick you?
You find out when they announce the selections. The students hand in their wish list, and the administrators try to match the wishes with the faculty, and then they have a faculty meeting, and you find out who your students are there.
Now,
they don't give you the reasons why.
Did the students ever give you the reasons why?
They say, you know, they're happy to have me and all that sort of thing, but they don't really feel obliged to spell it out terribly.
How does that inform your teaching methods, being picked rather than the students blindly selecting your course?
Well, it makes it easier because basically you're working with people who sort of want to be there instead of students who just got assigned there. And, you know, sometimes it's fine when they just get assigned, and other times, you know, it doesn't work out that well. So especially on where you're spending that much time one-on-one with somebody, you want to the students really need to have somebody they feel comfortable with. And so this system helps rather than just assigning them to teachers without consulting them. They spend 2 days interviewing us, and then the assignments are made after that.
Is this a trend in fine arts?
Yes,
academia.
It's these programs started with places like Warren Wilson College and Goddard College on the East Coast, and now they're popping up all over the country. They're East Coast, West Coast, North, South. They're a very popular way to teach writing at the MFA level.
East Coast, West Coast, North, South.
Yep.
You sound like a rapper.
Yeah.
I mean. Do you ever feel like, based on Ship of Fool, the musical, and what we heard, and the lyrical delivery, do you ever feel like you either missed out on a career as a songwriter or could have had a shot as a career?
Well, I had a crisis when I was an undergraduate, and as a lot of undergraduates do, I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do for a living and what I should be majoring in order to do this. So I took one of those tests about, you know, what you should be, you know, what your talents are and what you're cut out for, and number one on the test results was performing musician, which unfortunately I didn't play an instrument and so I had to kind of modify that, but I guess that sort of instinct was in me and worked its way into my poetry, and then the connection with Bob.
But you come close,
with
Ship of Fool, the musical.
Yeah,
that's not actually a musical.
That's right, the musical, non-musical.
What's next for you?
I'm going to do a new and selected, which is customary for poets to do once they get. This is Ship of Fools, my fifth full collection. I've also got three chapbooks, and so usually at that time and in my stage in life, one brings out what's called new and selected poems, and which consists of poems that are picked from all the books that you have published, plus a section of brand new poems.
New and selected,
yeah,
in other words.
Right. And it's usually much, much thicker than a regular regular poetry collections are sort of slim, and new and selected tends to be like 200, 250 pages.
Any readings, gigs, or appearances that we should know about coming up as well?
Nothing. Well, St. Louis is the nearest one. I'm reading at Webster College early April in St. Louis, Webster University, and then I'm doing a reading at Minnesota State in Mankato at the end of this month, and then going up to Minneapolis for a couple of gigs there. So I'm still keeping kind of busy doing readings for the book.
Our guest is poet, author, and English professor, the artist formerly known as William Trowbridge, a.k.a. Bill Trowbridge, whose latest work is called Ship of Fool. Just one fool, Ship of Fool, singular, a wily collection of poems depicting a man wandering aimlessly through everyday situations. And there's also the accompanying spoken word album, Ship of Fool, the musical.
And by the way, you can buy Ship of Fool, the musical, from villagerecords.com. If you want to pick up a copy of that, it's available there.
And back to Central Standard after that brief commercial.
All right. Thank you
for appearing on our show.
All right. Delighted.
And we'd like you to join us tomorrow as we chat with a couple of Sporting KC's footballers known here in America as soccer players. And we talk to them ahead of the home opener out at Livestrong Sporting Park this weekend. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with cave diver Kenny Brode. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.